These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
Did you grow up with brothers or sisters? Maybe you were the oldest child, looking out for the younger ones while conquering all the big life milestones first. Riding a bike, driving a car, the first kiss. Or perhaps you were the baby of the family and enjoyed all the special attention that came with being the youngest. Whether big sister or kid brother, one thing is true. Siblings have a relationship with one another like no other relationship in life. They are our first playmates and the people we can remain friends with as adults. That's the topic of Kids These Days today. We're talking about siblings with two professors who each have a unique perspective on this relationship. Also this hour, when one sibling has cancer, the other sibling needs extra special support. We'll learn about a group that's providing that, and then we'll meet four siblings in their 20s and 30s. They'll share their tips for enjoying friendship as adults. Stay with us, all that and more this hour on Kids These Days. Hi, I'm Kathleen McCoy, and I'm guest hosting Kids These Days today, in for regular host Shanna Sheehy. There have been a lot of topics covered so far on this show: education, health, safety, brain development, all focused on how to raise strong, happy, and healthy children. Well, there's a major component of a good upbringing that we've yet to cover, and so we're talking about it today. All those years of growing up with the people who figure the strongest in our childhood memories, the older brother who walked us to school, or the little sister who gave us her desserts. That's right, we're looking at the sibling relationship today, how it's changed throughout history, what it means in the present day, and why it's so important through the course of our lives. Before we begin our conversation today, we want to hear from you, and you can tell us your thoughts about sibling relationships. Drop us a line at mail@kidsthesedays.org. Now let's meet our guests. I'm joined today by two women who each have a very interesting view on siblings, a historian and a sociologist. Joining us on the phone from Pennsylvania is Dr. Dalit Hemphill. She's a professor of history at Sir Ursinus College in Pennsylvania. She's been teaching American history, women's history, and family history there since 1988. Dr. Hemphill is the author of Bowing to Necessities, A History of Manners in America, and the recently published Siblings, Brothers and Sisters in American History. She has seven siblings. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Hemphill.
Oh, it's great to be here.
And here in the studio with me is Dr. Ann Jackie. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and her area of focus is gerontology. She's also director of the Gerontology Minor Program at UAA. She'll be able to address the research on the long-term benefits of sibling relationships. She has three siblings. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Jackie.
I'm glad to be here.
All right. Well, let's get to the topic. This is such a rich one. I've got siblings. We all have sibling stories. So let's jump right in. Dalit, let's talk a little bit about your book, Siblings, Brothers and Sisters in American History. What period of history does it look at?
I look at American history from roughly, say, 1600 to about 1860. And the reason I look at that period is that that's the time when America changed dramatically from colonial, agricultural society to a democratic and industrial society. And so I wanted to see if there was change in the family and sibling relations that went along with that, the major change in society.
Right. And it's amazing to me how much we can look to that era and contrast it with what we see today. One of the best examples that I read in your book had to do with Benjamin Franklin and one of his sisters, Jane, and
yes,
and their sort of lifelong connection as siblings, which was really warm and really supportive. And you might not have guessed that maybe gender didn't play a role among siblings. They were more equals at that time than we might think of them now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, was a very interesting thing to me when I studied the history of the family and have been teaching it for years. And family historians, when they look at early American families, have long stressed that they were hierarchical, that parents were, you know, superior to children, and men were in charge of their wives. And there's a lot of truth in that. And so I expected sibling relationships to be similar. I expected the eldest male in the family to have more power than his younger siblings. What I found, though, is that sibling relationships actually were kind of the opposite of that, and almost acted as a sort of a safety valve almost for that inequality. So Ben and Jane, she was a little bit younger than he was, and of course shared with all women in her society a lesser role in terms of rights, etc. But they had a fairly equal relationship, and not only was she younger and a woman, but she turned out to be much less lucky than he was in terms of wealth and health, and he ended up helping her a lot. But that didn't seem to affect their relationship as equals. She followed his political career, but didn't hesitate to offer her opinion when something he did she didn't think was quite right. And he gave her lots of domestic advice. So it was really an interesting give and take. And
even in contrast to his own wife, who wasn't really free to make some of those political comments that his sister could make to him.
That's right. That's right. I compared their letters and the tone and subject matter of the letters between he and his sister and he and his wife was really rather different. So it made me think that brothers and sisters or sibling relations played a different role within families than did the marriage relationship or the parent-child relationship. I really do think it was a little bit more of a safety valve in this pretty hierarchical culture that brothers and sisters could, because they shared a generational kind of equality, they could help each other, they could sort of relax a little bit from the larger gender roles of their society, and things like that.
So, Anne, let's jump to the present a little bit. We've been looking at the past, but in the present, siblings maybe seem a little less connected than they did in early America. We have a history of starting out together, but then maybe branching off into our individual families more. What do you think about that? Do you think there's a contrast between that sort of lifelong connection that Ben and Jane had throughout their marriages and their ups and downs and political and economic adventures? Siblings today, do they stay as connected through their early adult life?
It's a different pattern, I think, and I've only read a little bit of Dalit's work, the most recent article that you published, which makes it pretty clear that there's lots of socializing in the early 20s all the way through middle adulthood, and that does still happen. But the more typical pattern is that starting in late adolescence, maybe even middle adolescence, all the way to the launching of the first child and retirement, siblings often have very little connection to each other, just for major holidays and for crisis. Mm-hmm. But the most typical pattern is that siblings come together in late adulthood, 65, 70, and they renew those relationships, that they just don't die. That the sibling relationship all across history is probably the longest adult relationship or relationship anybody can have. So we have lots of instances in the research of real close relationships that get reestablished in the 60s and 70s.
Really interesting. Well, you're listening to Kids These Days on this listener-supported station. I'm Kathleen McCoy, and today we're speaking with Dr. Anne Jackie, a sociology professor at UAA, and Dr. Dalit Hemphill, a history professor at Ursinus University in Pennsylvania. And we're talking about siblings. Still coming up this hour, siblings of children with cancer need a special kind of support, and we'll learn about one organization that is doing just that. Well, just to pick up where we were, I really am interested in the distinctions between siblings in early America and siblings today, and wanted to pose to both of you why. Why is it so different? It has a lot to do probably with the family systems that these siblings grew up in, the messages they were getting from parents. And so I'm sort of thinking we could talk a little bit about what messages did parents give their children about their siblings in early America versus perhaps the messages they're getting from their parents today about how to deal with siblings. Could you jump in on that, Dalit?
Sure, I'd love to. Yeah, and to me this is really important because what I found is parents were raising their children in the context of a larger culture that had certain ideals and ideas about family life that, depending on the period, you can find in everything from preacher sermons to children's literature, whatever. And in looking at this and looking at letters between parents and children and diaries, what I found is that there was not a whole lot of discussion of sibling relations in colonial America. As I mentioned earlier, families were very patriarchal, and so when people talked about family life, they stressed the authority of husbands over wives and parents over children. And because siblings didn't really fit that pattern, they just did not talk about siblings. I thought at least, you know, ministers would use biblical stories about siblings, of which there are plenty, but they really didn't. What happens is after the American Revolution, and as part of the whole cultural revolution that accompanied it, and a cultural embracing of the at least the ideals of liberty and equality, siblings could freely express the love that they had always felt for each other. And when young people who grew up during the Revolution and thereafter, when they had their own children, they really stressed the importance of sibling affection. And you can see it in the children's stories that they began to import and to write, and in the family portraits that they had artists paint. They just began to stress the importance of children playing together and loving each other and being friends. And I think this really sort of took hold. I think, as I said earlier, I think the sibling relationship has sort of an inherent natural equality and love, but I do think that a culture can reinforce that by having parents really stress the importance of friendship or de-emphasize it.
Mm-hmm.
One little contrast I'll give that I think is really striking is it was pretty much taboo to talk about family quarrels in the 19th century. Very few letters or diaries talk about it. That's not to say that siblings didn't fight, but you just didn't talk about it.
And that's
today,
such a contrast.
If you Google siblings on Amazon.com, you will come up with 9 out of 10 books helping parents deal with the expected sibling rivalry. And sibling rivalry just is not an issue in early 19th century America. It was just the stress was so much on sibling love. So I think there's a cultural message that parents really pushed. I think that there are other things going on as well, but that's a big issue.
So Anne, let's jump to you a little bit for a little bit of perspective in modern families. I know that sibling rivalry, certainly I grew up hearing all about it. And I know from a little bit of Dr. Hemphill's work that Sigmund Freud actually introduced that idea, and that became sort of a normal thing to talk about, in contrast to sort of early America, where either siblings weren't even really discussed or it was a very loving relationship reinforced in the family, to today, which is your kids are expected to squawk, they're expected to have these backseat arguments. That's just part of family life. Do you think that parents are looking at their children a little differently and maybe tolerating some rivalries that are allowing them to grow now?
You may see more sibling rivalries in books and on television too, all across the lifespan that Bart and Lisa Simpson come to mind. But there's another structural thing that I think we have now that we didn't have historically, and that is age-graded activities from early child care through school, through recreation, and even in churches, mm-hmm. so that families are not necessarily spending free time together. Mm-hmm. When you're trying to find childcare for your kids, you tend to put them in childcare for, you know, up to 9 months, or toilet trained children, and then in school they go to pre-kindergarten and all the way through school and college based on their age. and rather than on family structures, and that happens in recreation too. So that's a structural issue that probably wasn't happening historically that separates, so you have less less family history together too.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think that's absolutely the case. You know, age grading doesn't really come in till the end of the 19th century, and you know, if most of America was agricultural for most of our history, this means families were living on farms, and your playmates are your siblings. And of course, there's also the issue of family size.
Right, and actually, I want to introduce this interesting interview we also have for our listeners today. And here, the issue is illness in a family, one sibling being ill. So when you have a situation like that, it takes a toll on all the family members. It can especially affect siblings of the sick child who experience feelings of fear or anxiety or sadness, and they also tend to get less attention than their ill brother or sister. So Super Sibs is an organization serving exactly these kinds of kids. Through referrals from all 50 states and every province in Canada, they've ensured that no brother or sister of a sibling with cancer goes unsupported. Kids These Days producer Sarah Gonzalez spoke with the founder of Super Sibs, Melanie Goldish, from her office in Illinois.
Hi, Melanie. Thank you for joining us on Kids These Days.
I'm so pleased to be here. Thanks, Sarah.
I understand that you began Super Sibs because you have two sons yourself, and one of your sons is a cancer survivor, and his experience as well as the experience of his sibling were the motivating factors for getting Super Sibs going. Can you tell us more about the beginnings of Super Sibs and your own family's experience?
Sure. It was quite an eye-opener in so many ways. Back in 1998, when my son Travis, who was 5 years old at the time, was diagnosed with cancer, my younger son Spencer, who was 4 years old, was profoundly affected by his brother becoming so devastatingly ill at the time. And if this had just been our family, we would have dealt with it and moved forward as best we could. But when I started to look around and speak to other children and other teen siblings and their parents and then professionals, I learned, my gosh, this isn't just us. And further, the research showed when a child is diagnosed with cancer, everyone in the family needs healing, including siblings. So truly, it's like the brothers and sisters when a child has cancer or any life-threatening illness for that matter. It's like they receive the diagnosis, but emotionally as well. So that's when I decided, listen, someone needs to do something about this, and launched Super Sibs.
So what is it like for the siblings whose brothers and sisters have cancer? What sorts of stories do you hear? What are they going through?
Well, I'll share first our own. When I asked my youngest son, what did it feel like when your brother had cancer? He was 5 years old at the time when he answered, and he said, Mom, it felt like when my brother had cancer, someone tore my body in half. Mm. And to me, that was such a visceral way to describe how he felt, as if it was he physically who had been affected, because their so tight relationship, their bond had just been ripped apart by this horrible disease and all that we were going through. That's one example. Another that I think epitomizes for so many siblings, they become, unfortunately, the conduit for medical information for the whole community when people say, how's your sister doing? How's your brother doing? And in fact, often feel like they've lost their own identity. Mm-hmm. One of our Super Sibs kids said she went to camp, and when she arrived, she had a piece of tape on her forehead that she put there, and it said, my name's Catherine, not how's Hollis. Mm. So it's really important for us to remember these kids feel like they are often so insignificant or forgotten or feel guilty or afraid or angry at what's happening in their family, yet we know we can help them promote more resilience and empathy and stronger relationships with their family if we support them.
Let's talk then about what Super Sibs does to support siblings.
What we realize is the best way to support the brothers and sisters is to sort of meet them where they are. And so they don't have to come to us to get support. Rather, at any time, day or night, they can receive support tools right there on our website at supersibs.org. And they can go into that section called the Sib Spot. and click in their age group, and they'll find letters from other siblings of support, inspiration tools, journals that they can complete, and as well as tips of how to help get through such a difficult time in their lives, which may actually go on for years. There's also a section on our website called For You, and that's for parents and for school professionals, religious or spiritual leaders, as well as the medical and psychosocial professionals, each one that can have their own series of tools of how to help the brothers and sisters. But aside from that, when a child or a teen is referred into our program, we send age-appropriate comfort and care mailings, so that it comes right to their mailbox. We send everything from journals to help them express their sibling experience, to books, to personalized engraved courage trophies, to real messages of inspiration to remind them they're not alone, it's okay to feel how you feel, and we're here to help you to get through this with strength, courage, and hope.
The brother or sister may not recover. When do you also, are you providing bereavement services? I mean, how do you even help a sibling through that?
Yes, it's so vital that the families realize this, that if a child passes away from cancer, we still support those brothers and sisters. And as we say it, once a super sib, always a super sib. We serve siblings between the ages of 4 through 18. And if a child passes away from cancer, we provide this wonderful series of grief comfort packages and newsletters that are appropriate for siblings who've gone through what they've gone through, this tremendous loss. And I have to say, we also have wonderful friends in Alaska who have created a fabulous program called Camp Coho, and it's for siblings who have lost their brother or sister to cancer. And it's absolutely terrific. It's put together by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also excellent sibling camp in Seattle for patients as well as their brothers and sisters, and that's called Camp Good Times West.
Melanie, what is it about the sibling relationship that is so important and that drives the work that you do?
You know, when you think about it, the brother and sister relationship is the longest relationship any of us have in our lifetime, longer than with our parents, longer than with our best friends, and longer with our teachers. So whether we would choose that brother or sister or not, they're there for life. And what we found is, it's really in a situation like this that is so life-threatening and devastating, it's profoundly important that not only the child with cancer needs to be supported to have the best chance for survival, but so does that brother or sister have the most effective support to have emotional healing for the future. And the best way we can do that is provide integrated support for the whole family, so that those siblings can continue to either go forward with their strong relationship together or find this incredible bond as they move forward through and beyond the cancer journey.
Melanie Goldish, thank you so much for joining us on Kids These Days.
It's an absolute pleasure to serve the families in your beautiful state.
Thanks.
That was our producer, Sarah Gonzalez, speaking with Melanie Goldish, the founder of Super Sibs, a North American-wide support system for kids who have siblings with cancer. Visit kidsthesedays.org to connect to Super Sibs or to refer a sibling to this free program. So, Anna Dallet, following up on that story, I just couldn't help thinking about the support, the unique support opportunities siblings have for each other. And both in reading Dallet's work and I'm assuming with your look at gerontology and older siblings, how well are we relying on our siblings today as we age? What would you say about that, Anne?
I have a couple things to say about that. One, the loss of a sibling in late life is harder to recover from than any other loss, including the loss of a spouse.
That's remarkable.
When people are asked to, you know, rate your reaction to bereavement, there have been a couple studies on that. So you never get over the loss of a sibling. It doesn't get better. Most older people haven't lost a sibling until they're in their 70s. And then the other thing is that when siblings do come together, it's commonly over the widowhood of one spouse or an illness of a sibling or the illness and need for care of a parent.
How about you, Dallet? What would you say about this sort of support role for when siblings are aging?
I think, you know, it's a little bit different in the past because of different life expectancy and family patterns. But one thing that I was thinking when listening to the interview, that I think that they did pretty well in the 19th century, I guess because they had to, was I think that they dealt with death and sibling death better than we do now. That there was, in some ways, it strikes us as strange in terms of bringing children in to see the body of a dead sibling or something like that. But what the comforting part, I think, is there was a lot of acknowledgement of sibling death and a lot of discussion, mostly in a Christian context, about how they will see their sibling in heaven someday, or et cetera. But there was a lot of talk about it, it makes sense when you think that death was sort of all pervasive, death in childhood in particular, and that's different now. But I think I was reminded by listening to the interview and listening to Anne that no matter when it occurs, a sibling's death is really a traumatic event. And I think that when we have the unusual but sad event of a death of a child, we tend to, you know, worry about the parents, and we kind of forget that sibling needs support because a really important part of their life has been taken away.
It sort of points.
I think.
Go ahead, Dalit.
Well, I just think that you know, even though that the life expectancy and the health situation was different in the 19th century, there's some things that we can learn, and this reminder that we've got to be aware of the impact of sibling death is really an important lesson.
Well, it just strikes me that one of the lessons coming out of the historical research is that siblings weren't overlooked at that time. But siblings seem to be more overlooked today, although as we age, we sort of return to that relationship. But that notion that the loss of a sibling, we don't get much consolation about that. It's, you know, the death of a child, the death of a parent seems to be more weighty than the death of a sibling. It just seems to be an overlooked relationship right now in ways that it wasn't in the past, basically because the family cultivated that relationship more in the past than they maybe do today.
But yeah, I think so, although I think it's really changing right now, that there's a lot of attention being paid to siblings in the last decade or so in terms of the scholarly research, and programs like this are sort of tuning back into it. And one sort of theory I have, and I wonder what Anne thinks of it, is the impact of family size. Families in the past weren't as big as we might imagine, given the lack of really effective birth control, because families were winnowed by death, but they were still bigger than they are today. And of course, many families today, many children growing up today, have only one sibling. And I think that alters the dynamic. I think when there's more of a brood, and when you don't have the age grading that Anne talked about, there's more of a gang of siblings that grows up together, and that becomes important. Well, today, families are smaller, but they're also more complicated. So I'm wondering how that's going to affect.
Well, let's pick that up with you, Anne, right after the break. You're listening to Kids These Days. Each week, we're talking about raising Alaska's future today. How many siblings did you grow up with? Did you have step-siblings, half-siblings, maybe even a twin? We're talking about all kinds of brother and sister relationships on the program today, and after a break, we'll continue that conversation. We'll also meet a local family with three sisters and one brother, plus their mom. They are all adults, and they are all living near one another for the first time in years. They're a lot of fun and have a lot to say about being siblings, so stay with us through this short break.
Yes, I had a dream. Stood beneath an orange sky, with my brother standing by, with my brother standing by. I said, said, brother, you know, it's a long road we've been walking on. Yes, it is, you know, brother, it is. Such a long road we've been walking on. Dream, I stood beneath an orange sky with my sister standing by, with my sister standing by. I said, here is what I know now, sister. Is what I know now goes with this. In your love, my salvation lies. In your love, my salvation lies. In your love, my salvation lies. In your love, in your love, in your love.
That darling newborn can mean the end of sleeping through the night for mom and dad, or staying up late to make sure that your teen comes in by curfew. Well, next time on Kids These Days, we delve into the sleep wars. How do you handle getting the littles in your life the sleep they need? And just how rested are you? Plus, we'll talk about nightmares and other sleep complications. Come on, put off those extra Z's you might otherwise get and listen when sleep's the topic on Kids These Days.
We're back. I'm Kathleen McCoy, your host of Kids These Days Today, and we're talking about siblings. We're looking at this special relationship from some interesting perspectives, a historical one and a sociological one. Our guests are Dr. Ann Jackie from the University of Alaska Anchorage's Sociology Department. She's a professor there, and her specialty is gerontology. And Dr. Dalit Hemphill joins us from Pennsylvania, where she's a history professor at Ursinus University. She's recently published a book on the history of siblings in the United States. Once again, ladies, thank you for joining us. Let's get back to our discussion. And I want to pick up where we were. Dalit was just raising the issue of whether our smaller families today are actually any less complicated than the larger families of history. And so, Anne, let's go there. Let's talk about our modern families. And even though there may only be one or two children, are they really that small?
Well, a couple of interesting things. One is that the baby boomers, in most cases, have more siblings than they have children. So that's a pretty striking statistic that leads us to think that you would have, that the next generation would have fewer siblings to choose from. And that, it's true. And the other thing is that the siblings of the next generation are closer in age than they have been historically. If a woman had children from the time that she was 17 till the time she was 40, the siblings are very different from each other in age and their stage in the family life cycle and what they're doing in business. And so contemporary siblings are much closer in age. They have much more experiences in common. That's a difference. That's a demographic difference. But the other is this divorce, single-parent households, and blended families may make the sibling choices, and their choices now rather than family obligations, much bigger, so that you may have something closer to what happened historically, where you have, you know, a sibling that's quite a bit younger, a half sibling that's quite a bit younger or quite a bit older, and that has maybe even social class differences or race and ethnic differences compared to you. So it's quite true that the choices of sibling relationships are much more complex than they have been historically.
I think that one of the things I think is great to talk about, I'm thinking about my husband who was 17 when his twin brothers were born. And so he was really placed a lot in that older caretaker role. And that's kind of something, Daryl, that you talked about in your history, the elder sister role, and the contrast with that today, which is parents don't seem to want to burden their older child with taking care of the younger ones. Either it's considered not good enough that they're still a child, or it's too burdensome. And yet, historically, it was really almost an honored role for the elder sister. Is that right, Dad?
Yeah, I think it's something that developed in the 19th century when women's various roles within the family were undergoing some change, and we talk about new roles for wives and mothers, but we haven't really acknowledged siblings. And I was really struck when reading advice books and children's literature, and then I found it in diaries as well, that the honored role of the elder sister, almost a sort of a deputy mother kind of role, that she was supposed to help provide sort of order and government in the family. And I tend to think of it as a sort of family government that was sort of okay in a democratic society. It's not like the old primogeniture of the power of the eldest male. I think that this giving sister a special role was something that was comfortable but very helpful in the family. And one of the things that struck me is in reading about baby boom families, which Anne rightly observed are sort of abnormally large for the modern period, that the people who study large baby boom families found that older sisters were playing the same kind of helping role, but they weren't getting the praise and credit for it that they were in the 19th century. And I thought, well, that may be something that if a child is taking on an especially helpful role, and I think there's nothing wrong with sibling caretaking, they should be praised for it, and it should be regarded as a positive thing.
Do you think that's true, Anne, that they don't get the credit today that they once did?
In childhood, I think that probably really is true, mostly because we have the expectation that other institutions, that the parents, especially the mother, should arrange to have the children cared for by other institutions. We still have that in late life. But one of the things we don't have, and I hadn't even thought about this until Dalit talked about what happens historically in childhood, is a real clear designation about who cares for parents in late life. And most typically it's one sibling, and one sibling may actually organize the other siblings in it, but one sibling takes that role, but it's not clear which sibling it is. It's not the oldest daughter, it's usually a woman, but it can be a son. And so we don't have, you know, advice books about that have begun in childhood that continue. It's a developing family relationship that just happens when there's a crisis.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to remind listeners that this is Kids These Days, and on this day we're talking about siblings with our two guests, Dr. Dalit Hemphill and Dr. Anne Jackey. I wanted to ask Anne what role Alaska plays in this sibling. I told you that I followed my brother up here, but one of the common things you hear in Alaska is you make your own families here. What do you think about that? Do you think sibling relationships are strong here, maybe more strong in people who are born and raised in Alaska than people who travel to Alaska?
I've not studied that, but I know anecdotally that many of my same age peers who have adult children talk about lots of regular activities. I have one friend who has regular Saturday breakfast for her adult children and her adult children's friends, and sometimes her own friends come to those breakfasts. And weddings are opportunities for that sort of thing, and other kinds of family events. So I do know of lots of regular sibling activity that are very similar to the activities that were described in the history book.
Right, right. So often it seems people come to appreciate their siblings a little later in life. That's something that Anne's been sort of talking about, once they don't all live under the same roof together. Kids These Days contributor Jessica Cochran recently met four siblings, and their mom too, who clearly enjoy each other's company. In order to find out what makes these three sisters and one brother so close now that they are all adults.
Hi, I'm Deborah Burns. I'm the mom.
I am Rebecca Leon. I'm the oldest child. I am a state employee. And
her favorite color is beige.
And my favorite color is beige.
I'm Hannah. I'm 23. I'm the baby. And I'm a licensed esthetician. I work at Dermaglow in Wasilla. And I'm also an aspiring musician.
My name's Cliff. I'm 28. I'm in the UAA civil engineering program.
I'm Christina.
I am the third child.
Slash the middle
child. Middle girl, anyways.
Well, I have four of my own born. I have one deceased bonus child, and like five foster children.
Seriously, I don't think I know any other person on the planet that is as good with teenagers as my mom. She is the most amazing individual. Like, if anybody needs, like, advice on how to handle teenagers, my mom
Please
needs...
don't call me.
But she's amazing. Like, she's super patient. She's very rigid. She doesn't take things, like, personally. Like, when teenagers are notorious for being like, I hate you, you know, when they don't get their way. And mom's like, okay. So she just doesn't take things personally.
I don't care. You can hate me, but you're still going to do what I say.
Yeah, so she's just great that way.
Yeah, I mean, like, I had kind of, like, a different relationship with all my different sisters. You know, picked on Hannah a lot, unfortunately.
He was my bully.
Grown out of that, thankfully.
I love him. He's my teddy bear.
No, I'm kidding.
Christina and I have always had, like, the feud going, like, this rivalry competition thing. I guess because we're competing for the middle child. But I totally stomp her at basketball. She's currently been beating me at Words with Friends, which is unfortunate. But I'm hoping to make a comeback soon. Probably not this game. And then Rebecca and I don't know if we have much of a competition or, like, a rivalry or anything like that. I mean, I try and learn a lot from her. I mean, I'm a staff sergeant in the Air Force, and I still think she's a lot more responsible than I am. So I try and look up to her in a lot of ways, too.
Cliff.
I think that a lot of times our culture is so against arguing and fighting, and I think sometimes parents maybe protect their children a little too much, and I think that we fight a lot, but we fight well, and we're able to discuss and talk about what we feel very openly and not take too many things too personally. And I think that's really, really important that you can fight and fight well.
You know, I'd say, you know what? Don't come to me. Figure it out. Work it out. Deal with it. You know, you got a problem? Go talk to him. And occasionally it would get physical and I'd have to step in the middle. And, you know, I was always bigger than them, so it worked.
So was there a time when you all hated each other or just didn't want to spend time together?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
when we all lived together... and we were immature. I'm sure we were at each other's throats quite a bit more than we are now. But luckily, like, during the transition of us filtering through high school, we didn't really, like, spend a lot of time together. There was a number of years prior to now where we didn't even live in the same state. So last couple of years have been pretty nice. We've all lived in Anchorage. And
Do you think you guys are closer to each other than... other siblings that you know, like, are their siblings?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
What do you attribute that to?
Lost kids.
Okay, that is
Lost kids.
Lost kids was a game that we played when we were little.
Okay, I may or may not have had some major abandonment issues.
And so we played, I created this game that we called Lost Kids. And I don't know if Mom knows this.
I do.
Oh, you do? Okay. And we would enact that we would hear our parents trying to get rid of us. And so we would decide that we're going to run away from home before we could be abandoned. And we would, we would just go play out in the woods. But we moved around a lot, and Mom always, like, there was house rules that included playing with your siblings, like...
And no TV.
And no television.
We never had television. We never had video games.
Yeah.
She refused to buy us any kind of video games. Yeah. All we had was, like... Anne of Green Gables and
like, on her own.
The movie On Her Own, which is our family's life.
We went on a lot of family vacations where, you know,
lots of driving vacations.
Yeah.
Road trips, not like family vacations. Like, we would drive to, like, nature.
That was our family vacation.
we would just drive aimlessly around logging roads yes. for no reason that I could ever...
Yeah, in Oregon and Washington. And so we spent a lot of time together. But, like, I remember when the kids were young.
We were trapped together.
One thing, once the kids were able, they were tall enough to be able to reach my bedroom door, I had to play with them. So that was, like, a house rule. And so you just got forced and, like, there wasn't any other option. Like, you had to play with each other. But now I can see why... that was beneficial because we really actually like are very, very close and other people just aren't, they're just not close like that. And that's really mm-hmm. sad.
I told my kids, you know what? The only people you will ever always have in your life are your siblings. You will only have your brother and your sisters in your life and your friends will come and go and you're only going to have them. Those are your best friends. Those are the people that you're going to grow up with. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I'm just like, these are your best friends. These are the people that love you, that care about you. This is your family.
Jessica Cochran spoke with Rebecca, Clifford, Christina, and Hannah, and their mom, Deborah, in Anchorage. Check out kidsthesedays.org to see a few of their family photos. So that was really a fun story. It brought back a lot of memories for me because the Leanne family talked about their road trips together as kids. My family went cross country in a station wagon many times because my folks were from the East Coast and we were on the West Coast, so we were going back to visit them. I thought it was pretty funny that they had a game that they played a game called Lost Kids with no parents and they had to figure out how to survive. And that's certainly got to be a sibling bonding experience. But the thing I'd like to talk a little bit about is they refer to their mom as really emphasizing playing together, that they were going to be their best friends for life, and that they should work out issues together and not let anything come between them. And I think that we see a difference in history. I wonder if you think we do see a difference in history and contemporary parenting setting children up to be these best friends. Let's start with you, Anne. What do you think? Do you think modern parents also see the strength of the sibling relationship as their children move through life and want to reinforce it?
Probably reflecting on their own experiences, they do. I don't know if we're giving modern parents a lot of direction in actually how to do that. Shows like this show how important it is to do that. I think the historical work that we've talked about and then the work in social gerontology that shows siblings as really important confidants that help you make sense of health and finances and other kinds of relationships. If you know that ahead of time, then you can be much more careful about helping people to resolve your own children to resolve problems as they're happening.
So that they don't become these grudges that later in life are still there, you know, and they keep them from getting together over these big life issues that they can support each other in, right?
Well, one thing is to be relaxed about that because we do know from the research that most of those kinds of grudges get resolved in late life. That when they don't, that's on the biggest list of regrets, unresolved relationships with siblings. You know, they're relatively rare compared to most relationships with siblings in late life. Most of those things just kind of dissolve or get worked out as people are dealing with the kinds of things you come back to, which is dealing with somebody's illness, with
or
somebody's
somebody's
bereavement.
Sort of, it's all little. It's all little compared to the big stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
But it's important, and I think that some kind of modeling about that while you're children and while you're young adults is a good idea.
Yeah, I was just struck in historically how much early American families really, really emphasized that.
Yeah. I mean, I think we can't generalize too much. I mean, every family is different and every family has a different culture. But it did strike me that there is more sort of tolerance or expectation of sibling competition and rivalry today than there was then, and you know, I think that's fine, but I do think modeling of the sort that the family that you interviewed provides is should be encouraged. I mean, it's good to talk about it as parents sort of worry about how to bring up their kids. I think it's not a bad thing to be more proactive in saying you're on the same team, you are each other's most important supporter through life, and to really articulate that culture. It's really what inspired me to study siblings, because as you mentioned at the outset, I have seven siblings, and my parents very much had you're all on the same team kind of approach to raising us. And when I went as a historian to study family history, I couldn't understand why nobody talked about siblings, because they were the most important thing in my family, and that sort of led me into it. So I think, of course, there are, you know, the vast majority of families, as Anne was saying, either have positive relationships, or if there's conflict, they do work it out. But I think we can be even more proactive in stressing the importance of sibling love.
Yeah. I am thinking that the opportunity here really is to look back at history and use it to look at the sibling relationship today and see the opportunities there. That's a point that you make, Dalit, that we can look back and see what rich relationships these were at one time, and perhaps we're neglecting it a little bit today, and that there's great opportunity to remember or even to acknowledge that the power of these relationships. We see it when we lose a sibling. Anne talked about that. It's a relationship we don't get over, actually, yeah. a loss that we don't get over. And then as we age and we have divorce, remarriage, maybe our siblings are the ones that are still there when we are right. 70.
You know, one thing that I was thinking is that sort of along these lines is that in many ways I think we can just take comfort from the past. We were talking earlier about the complexity of today's blended families with the results of divorce and remarriage. You have half siblings and step siblings. And in fact, you know, that was very common in early America. Not so much the result of divorce, but the result of earlier death and remarriage. And the one thing that was striking is that, and it makes it hard to research, is that siblings would never refer to each other as a half-sibling or a sibling-in-law, or they were just a brother or sister. And that's, I think, a cue for us that we should not make distinctions, that when families blend, we should blend and realize, hey, this is a way of making a large family out of maybe what began as a smaller family, and have the richness of more choices, as Anne said earlier. So in some ways, the past can be comforting. Because we have higher divorce and blended families now, doesn't mean that the family is going down the drain or is fragile or anything like that, or doesn't have to be.
Well, that's all the time we have this hour to talk about siblings, but the conversation continues online. So please visit us at kidsthesedays.org to have your say and let us know what you think about sisters and brothers. Thanks so much to Dr. Anne Jackie and Dr. Dalit Hemphill, who have been our guests today. It's been a pleasure having you both here with us. Thank you. Thank you, Dalit, and thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
Dr. Dalit Hemphill is a professor of history at Ursinus College in Pennsylvania. Her book, Siblings, Brothers and Sisters in American History, was recently published by Oxford University Press. Dr. Anne Jackie is a professor of sociology at the University of Alaska Anchorage, where her area of focus is gerontology. You can find information about everything you've heard here today, our guests, books and studies we've mentioned, and organizations by visiting kidsthesedays.org. Before we wrap today, we have one more piece to share with you. Aaron Kirkland, Alaskan family travel guru of AK on the Go, remembers the fun of road tripping with her siblings back in the day.
I swear, my parents bought a Volkswagen bus with their children's road-tripping future in mind. Big enough for gear and kids, it was way more than just effective seating arrangements for our family of five. The bus, you see, had one other notable attribute. It was noisy as heck, so Mom and Dad were oblivious to all but the worst sibling behaviors as we downshifted our way across the Cascade Range in search of family travel bliss. According to my mother, every road trip was delightful, every stop full of wonder, because, she pointed out later, we were together. And perhaps she was right. In this age of jet-setting vacationers who want to get to their destination and get there quick, a family road trip offered a change of scene for three siblings who ordinarily didn't give each other so much as a backward glance during the week. Always busy with our own stuff, family vacations were sacred blacktop upon which the bus happily cruised. Traveling with my sister and brother meant learning new things, valuable skills that undoubtedly would carry me into womanhood. Poker was one. My brother taught my younger sister and me how to recognize a flush from a straight huddled in the back of the bus using peanut M&Ms as chips. Negotiating was the other. The endless, "You give me that or I'll tell Mom," only worked when we were sitting at a stoplight and forced me to resort to other, more covert ways of getting what I wanted. But I also learned this. I'm the middle child, the dreamer, the one who could just as easily gaze out the window for hours, scanning a horizon for cowboys or birds, or tumbling tumbleweeds along the vast eastern Washington landscape. My sister was the social one, talking to park rangers and store owners with the confidence of a presidential candidate. My older brother was somewhere in between, engaged without flamboyance, but more interested in bizarre facts about a place rather than its outward appearance. Traveling together meant the three of us had to coexist within a virtual biosphere of German engineering for however long we were trapped in our seatbelts. Whereas my younger sister might indeed be a pest at home, she became a valuable ally when confronted by strangers wanting to know how old I was or where we lived. My brother, he provided the entertainment, knowing just how far to push my parents after a long, hot day in the Volkswagen bus. I always felt a little sad when we pulled wearily into our driveway at home, for I knew the next morning we'd be back to normal, pulling and tugging at each other like a pack of wet alley cats. Our mother would always say with an edge of frustration to her voice, "Why can't you kids behave like we're still on vacation?" We were never able to answer that, until now, because we're parents too. For Kids These Days, I'm Erin Kirkland.
That was Erin Kirkland. You can read her original blog that she writes for us each Friday by visiting kidsthesedays.org. Look for the KTD on the Go icon in the sidebar. Thank you for joining us on Kids These Days today. We hope you'll join us again next time. By visiting our website at kidsthesedays.org, you can learn what's coming up next and listen to all existing episodes to date. We had help today from our regular contributor, Jessica Cochran, who reported from Anchorage, and from Erin Kirkland. Shanna Sheehy is this program's regular host. Our producer is Sarah Gonzalez, and she also keeps our website, kidsthesedays.org, fresh all week long. Be sure to check out our guest bloggers and all the special features we have compiled there for you. Go ahead and like us on Facebook so you can stay in touch with us. Thanks for joining me, Kathleen McCoy, your guest host today, for this ongoing conversation about raising Alaska's future today. See you next time.
The ideas, opinions, and commentary you hear on Kids These Days are those of the hosts, guests, and contributors, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of its funders or broadcast partners. The Content Producers Guild is solely responsible for what you hear on the program. Kids These Days is made possible by a generous grant from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Kids These Days is produced in partnership with KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage, KRUA, and the UAA Department of Journalism and Public Communications.